At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
An example of how capital drives innovation, Black communities using federal stimulus dollars to start businesses. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, May 25th. Glad you could join us. Today is, of course, the one-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. In a year of protest and reckoning, there have been signs of hope, even during a pandemic that hit Black Americans particularly hard and closed many Black-owned businesses. New data suggests that people in Black communities started new businesses over the last year in cities like New York, Houston, and Atlanta. The study from the National Bureau of Economic Research says Black Americans were more likely than white Americans to take steps toward entrepreneurship during the pandemic. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on why.
So the study found that after economic relief packages passed last year, there was a big surge in registered business formations in the following weeks. Catherine Fazio teaches business at Boston University and helped write the study. She says that's despite the CARES Act not directly infusing any money into new businesses.
Its purpose was not to catalyze a lot of startup formation. So it was very interesting for us to see that the CARES Act had that ripple effect.
Another reason for the surge in Black entrepreneurship could be that Americans now have a better understanding of historic inequality. Jorge Guzman is an assistant professor of management at Columbia University and a co-author of the study.
There's been clear intent in banks and government, et cetera, to make sure all the financial support throughout this year reaches Black neighborhoods.
And Andre Perry says that speaks to a bigger lesson to be learned from this study about access to capital. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
If you really want to see the economy grow, figure out the ways to invest in the underappreciated assets in our community. And that happens to be Black and brown communities. It happens to be Black and brown entrepreneurs.
He says Black people represent about 14% of the population in the U.S., but only 2% of all businesses with more than one employee. This investment in Black businesses, he says, shouldn't be a pandemic-induced anomaly. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Across America, businesses are hoping for a recovery summer. But many of those businesses still can't hire people, especially the ones that rely on seasonal workers. Today, the federal government raised the cap on H-2B visas for foreign guest workers, so those companies can apply for overseas help. But aren't there a lot of unemployed Americans they could hire? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that one.
Amusements of America usually hires about 80 people to run these scream-inducing rides at its movable country fair. About half the hires are foreign guest workers.
They are the ride operators. They are the mechanics.
Dominic Vivona's family owns the company. He says this year he didn't get any of the H-2B visas he asked for. Starting today, employers could apply for 22,000 additional H-2B visas, so Vivona is applying. He says it's hard to find Americans for these jobs.
You're living on site in RVs. That's not everybody's lifestyle.
Plus, Vivona says his jobs end when he closes in November. Daniel Costa at the Economic Policy Institute says employers should try harder to hire Americans. The unemployment rate in the hospitality business is still at almost 14%.
At the national level, at least, there are not signs of labor shortages in these occupations.
Costa wants to beef up existing requirements that employers search for American workers before applying for guest worker visas. But John Basilisi of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says this is no time to tighten the rules.
There's a lot of businesses who are telling me, like, our survival relies upon our ability to meet our workforce needs.
Basilisi says these seasonal businesses won't survive another summer like last year, where they barely scraped by. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, reopening and recovery are clearly not a straight line. No one was quite sure what to do today. We'll have more details when we do the numbers. Now to climate and the financial tools that people are creating to incentivize low-carbon technologies and markets. One way that companies get around caps on pollution is to buy carbon pollution permits in a system known as cap and trade. Now, an American economics professor has created a nonprofit called Climate Vault to let people or companies buy expiring permits and lock them up so they can't be used, meaning, ideally, the carbon pollution they allow won't ever happen. Marketplace's Scott Tong explains.
Some states, like California and Vermont, have a trading system in place to buy and sell pollution permits to belch CO2. Greener companies sell their permits to dirtier companies. Now, this new Climate Vault lets investors, big and small, buy those permits and lock them away. Michael Greenstone, an economist at the University of Chicago, is the founder.
My children, for a holiday gift this year, I purchased 60 tons on their behalf to undo their footprint.
That reduces the overall cap on CO2 emissions in the state. It sticks the permits in the vault, as it were. Now, this vault can be opened, but only to give permits to companies that pull carbon out of the atmosphere. Now, how do they take the carbon out? John Larson at the Rhodium Group Consultancy explains the concept.
You are taking some sort of filter, and you're shoving as much air through that filter as you possibly can. The CO2 sticks to the filter, and then you use energy to remove the CO2 from that filter.
This idea of direct air capture may be a decade away from being commercial and affordable. Janet Peace is with Blue Source, a climate consultancy.
We really do need to be investing in it to bring down the price tag. The International Energy Agency said that, you know, we can't solve climate change in many of their economic models unless we're using carbon capture and storage.
Peace says incentives from the Climate Vault, plus government grants and tax breaks, could speed things up. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We've been covering climate, tech, and money on my other show, Marketplace Tech. Find our coverage at marketplace.org/climate. Yesterday on the program, we talked about all the companies that made diversity and equity pledges since George Floyd's murder and the spotlight on racial injustice that followed. Many tech companies were among those that pledged to make this notoriously non-diverse industry more inclusive. So I spoke with Megan Rose Dickey. She's a senior reporter at Protocol, where she covers labor and diversity in tech. Megan, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So as we look back over the last year, remind us about the kinds of pledges that tech companies made around hiring and promotions and culture.
Yeah, so some companies, you know, they made financial commitments. Other companies made representation commitments pertaining to their respective workforces. It's hard to know exactly how well they've done because a lot of those commitments were looking at, like, 2023 or 2025. So we're still not going to see if companies have really follow through with those commitments for a little while.
Right.
And then what about, yes, it is always somewhat convenient that it's just a little farther out than we can measure.
And they probably hope that we'll forget about it.
Yep, exactly. We're calling you every year, once a year. But then there is, you know, pledges about investments and hiring are hard to measure right now, but there is culture. And we've seen a lot of stories about culture and attempts to improve that, which is harder to measure. But have you seen any actions that seem promising?
There have been some actions. So I would point to Snap, for example. A big change that they made was around the use of racist language in their code database. So whether it's like master and slave or blacklist and whitelist. And so they're working on actually changing those terms. That's one small thing, but I think that's definitely a step in the right direction. And so last week, we found out that Google's dermatology app barely used any data from people with darker skin tones. Still, after all this time, like, how is that still what's happening? And it's, yeah, it's just kind of becoming comical at this point.
I mean, it is, and yet it really isn't. And I guess I wonder, you know, how do you think tech companies, we've seen tech companies get sort of more aggressive about pushing back against media and criticism. And I wonder if some of this is just being rejected.
I think that there are some companies that are hearing it, but I think sometimes the issue can be that there can be a disconnect between the diversity departments and the broader organization. So while you might have a very ambitious, hardworking team of people that are focused on diversity and inclusion, that doesn't always necessarily make its way over to, say, the engineering team or the executive team. And so I think that's just why it's so important that there's this buy-in from the entire company if they're really wanting to see real change. But then, of course, you know, you have companies like Coinbase and Basecamp and New Relic that are saying, don't expect us to really speak out about these types of racial or social or political issues.
Are there any tech companies you can think of that are doing this really well, that have really handled the last year well in a measurable way?
I've been asked that question a lot just over the years of covering D&I, and I used to say, like, Pinterest is doing really well. And then, you know, next thing we know, it's actually not doing well. And so I think that just goes to show that every company is going to have its issues. And I think there are still definitely things that some companies are doing that, you know, look good on the surface, you know, like with unconscious bias trainings or ally trainings. But I think the bigger, more important things need to come around, like really overhauling the hiring practices, like where they're recruiting from, and, you know, looking at the performance review process and seeing if there are biases and inequities in those. And if we're really wanting to see real change, then companies need to look at some of those more systemic processes that they have in place to really ensure that people of color and other underrepresented groups are really able to thrive at these companies and feel supported there.
Megan Rose Dickey is a senior reporter at Protocol, where she covers labor and diversity in tech. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up.
So I kind of just took a risk.
Sometimes you just have to dive on in. But first, let's do the numbers. A down day all around. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave up 81 points, about 0.25%, to finish at 34,312. The NASDAQ slipped 4 points, not even 0.1%, to end at 13,657. And the S&P 500 was down 8 points, 0.2%, to land at 4,188. Following up on Nancy Marshall Genzer's piece about temporary visas for seasonal summer work, including tourism, let's check in on Kai Rizdahl's favorite metric, how many people are flying in the U.S. Last Friday, 1.8 million people passed through TSA checkpoints, according to the agency. That is a lot better than the same Friday a year ago, when that number was just over 250,000. There is, though, still quite a ways to go before we're back to the 2.5 million people who flew on the same Friday back in 2019. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.56%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. If you're looking for some light beach reading for this weekend, might I suggest the newly updated Federal Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices? It's 800 pages of rules and guidelines on things like the right width of a bike lane and the proper placement of stop signs on freeway on-ramps. Fine, maybe it's not for you, but if you're a civil engineer or an urban planner, this is basically the Bible. And if you ask advocates for bikers and pedestrians, that Bible could use some rewrites because it's still a little too pro-car. And it may not sound cool to all of you, but infrastructure is a hot topic, so hot that it even has social media influencers. Marketplace's Matt Levin is in the crosswalk.
Imagine running into Frank Gehry standing outside a building he designed, or maybe Andy Warhol opening up a can of Campbell's soup. When Eduardo Corona saw Vignesh Swaminathan at the corner of 4th and San Fernando in downtown San Jose, it was kind of like that.
Mr. Barricade, right?
Thank you. You know who I am?
Yeah, I see you on TikTok, man.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Thank you. Cool, appreciate it.
Swaminathan is a 30-year-old civil engineer and CEO of Crossroad Lab in Cupertino, California. Eduardo Corona is one of 400,000 TikTok fans that know him better as Mr. Barricade, social media crusader for bicycle and pedestrian-friendly streets.
Hey y'all, Mr. Barricade here, and I want to show you this post. So you see this post right here? It's just a balloon. When I step on it, it folds flat, and it bounces back up. Like nothing.
Barricade! Mr. Barricade mashes beats from Kid Cudi with short lessons on the connection between redlining and potholes. He takes his followers to exotic locations, like storm drains. A creative guy. And that creativity is on full display at 4th and San Fernando, an intersection he redesigned into a bicyclist safe space.
The way this intersection works is that bicyclists are not expected to act like vehicles and weave over vehicle traffic to make left turns.
Instead, there's something called a bicycle box, a bright green oasis where bikes wait in front of cars for their own traffic signal. Parking lanes and bike lanes are flipped, and there are knee-high inflatable barricades basically everywhere. Like other transportation engineers, Mr. Barricade begins a project by dutifully consulting the Federal Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. And then sometimes he kind of has to ignore it.
What I've done with the projects that I worked on is I've read through the MTCD well. I put an additional extra safety element of it, of the posts and the reflectivity, and I make it very robust. And that's how I feel comfortable messing with the MUTCD.
Engineers have been messing with the MUTCD since it was created in the 1930s. Back then, the manual focused a lot on alerting drivers to railroad crossings, the big danger of the day. The goal? Street signs should look the same whether you were driving your Buick Roadster across the tracks in Missouri or California. But now the manual is an 862-page traffic engineering Bible, dictating the width of lane dividers to the proper size and color for a crosswalk. Solid white lines, no exceptions.
A stop sign shall be red, it shall be octagonal in shape. Pedestrian signs shall be yellow, or what they have adopted now is the fluorescent yellow-green.
Steve Oliver is with the city of Garland, Texas. He's been a traffic engineer for about 30 years. He was part of the team that updated the 2021 version of the MUTCD, the first update in over a decade. And let's just say it hasn't been very well received. One reason? Speed limits. The manual says cities should base them on how fast 85% of drivers would drive if there were no speed limits.
The stance and the thought has always been that motorists given to their own devices will pick a prudent speed at which to drive.
Shockingly, pedestrian and bicycle safety advocates have some issues with that methodology. They say it prioritizes cars over everything else. Zabe Ben is with the National Association of City Transportation Officials. It's one of several groups lobbying the Biden administration to chuck the update and rewrite the manual entirely.
Right now, it is mostly geared towards by sort of tradition and fiat. It's mostly geared towards the way drivers use the streets, and it thinks of other users as other users.
The manual isn't law. Cities can work around it and bring on someone like Mr. Barricade to reconfigure an intersection with a fancy new crosswalk and special bike lanes. Even though those features make cities more livable, there's an expensive reason cities don't fund them. Liability. Changes can require costly safety studies.
The city attorney, for example, can say, I won't sign off on that. The city engineer can say, I won't sign off on that.
So unsafe streets stay unsafe because they comply with the manual. It's just easier and cheaper that way. Tyrone Gordon is about to cross Sacramento's four-lane Stockton Boulevard. There's a crosswalk, but no traffic light. The speed limit is 35 miles an hour, but it sounds much faster.
Up your seat. Every time you try to cross, people just keep going. They don't respect the walkthrough, you know.
According to the manual, Tyrone would need to be one of nearly 100 pedestrians crossing an hour to get a crosswalk with a traffic signal. Or four pedestrians would need to be hit by a car in a three-year span.
Actually, I was thinking about calling the police to have them come down here and monitor this spot because they never stop. I mean, it's you just got to wait all day.
The Department of Transportation is reviewing the updated manual. Secretary Pete Buttigieg hasn't weighed in yet. Something for him to think about while he bikes into work. In Sacramento, I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
New data on the housing market came out today, and there is only one word for it. It's banana pants. The S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price Index is kind of the gold standard metric. Grew faster in March than it has in over 15 years. So, yeah, it's just getting more and more expensive to buy a house, despite and in part because of the pandemic. There was a big jump last year in the number of people buying homes for the first time. Which takes us to the subject of the next installment in our series, Adventures in Housing.
My name is Ko Bragg, and I am a journalist based in New Orleans. I honestly wasn't thinking about buying a home until the pandemic, when I was obviously in my apartment a lot more. I had been doing a lot of traveling before we all entered lockdown in the spring of 2020. The house that I ended up getting, I put a down payment on without ever seeing it. I did the click-through tour. I knew it was kind of close to the neighborhood that I wanted to be in. And so I kind of just took a risk. My mom helped me move in. And, you know, I bawled crying when my mom left. And I think it was just everything collapsing on me at once of like, I have a mortgage and furnishing and like doing all the things you need to do after you put that down payment on. I think that's what people don't tell you about, like how much it costs to just like, I don't know, the alarm system that makes me sleep better at night, getting the deck power washed or having the termite person come by to make sure that, you know, there's no termites in the wood. All of these questions that now I'm totally responsible for. But after this year of actually doing it on my own, I'm so glad that I've gotten this experience. I think particularly buying a home as a single Black woman, I think a lot of people count homeownership as something that you do once you are in a marriage where you are planning to have children. And like, I'm not willing to wait for those things to kind of build a stability that I want to have in my life. And so I think that it makes you kind of rethink, like, especially as a Black woman, the way that, I don't want to say I've been trained, but sort of society maybe does teach us in a way to like put ourselves last, because of that ends up being the hierarchical order in a lot of things. And so having my own space that is only mine, where I'm not actually waiting for permission from anyone, whether that be society standards around marriage and partnership and child rearing, to do anything, whether that be choosing what couch I want to put or not put in a room, has been really moving for me. I have a lovely, like, classic New Orleans front porch that I love to just like stand out on and, you know, wave at my neighbors. And I am like really proud of my ability to make a home for myself and go from feeling totally bewildered and almost having like buyer's remorse to moving independently and doing things that society makes it seem like you have to wait for.
Cobragg there in New Orleans, Louisiana. Just wonderful. You can tell us about your adventure in housing at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, I'm going to stick with housing for a second because despite that feel-good story, these numbers are mind-boggling. From that housing data out today, the median home sale price was up 20% over last year. Redfin CEO Glenn Kelman posted a Twitter thread of astonishing stats today, such as there are now more realtors than house listings. The typical home sells in just 17 days. And in Redfin's annual survey of home buyers, 63%. Like Co there said they bid on a house they had not seen in person. And finally, a woman in Maryland wrote a letter with her bid promising to name her firstborn child after the seller. But Kelman reports she lost that house. I don't really know what to say. Here's your moment of economic context. Oh, yeah, no, I am definitely still on housing because also, you know, that lumber shortage we keep talking about, that's just getting worse, too. Lumber prices are up 300%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Janet Nguyen, and Catherine Wiles. Satara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. And I'm Molly Wood. Don't worry, everyone. Kai will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.